The war stories you're about to hear are the kind that if you saw them in a movie would make you shake your head and say, come on, no way. But they are true. And each of the two Vietnam veterans on today's episode, both Navy SEALs, have the medals of honor to prove it.
We had a job to do, which we'd been trained very well to do. It was an unusual job, an unconventional job, a highly dangerous job. But you ran your missions because that's what you were sent there to do. And you never thought about, boy, I was successful on that one, or we got ambushed on this one. We almost didn't make it out. Am I going to make it on the next one? Are my people going to make it back? You don't think about those things. Each mission is a objective that you set out to accomplish and go after. Then you forget about that and you go on to the next one.
As Memorial Day approaches, we could think of nothing more compelling than this interview with Thomas Norris and Michael Thornton. Tommy Norris earned his Medal of Honor for retrieving an Air Force navigator whose plane was shot down over enemy lines. It was the longest, deadliest, and most daring rescue operation of the Vietnam War. Mike Thornton earned his Medal of Honor for rescuing Tommy Norris 6 months later. It was an act of such extreme valor and endurance that it defies belief. The stories of these two men are a reminder about the horror of war and the human capacity for strength and resilience. This is What It Takes, a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement. I'm your host, Alice Winkler.
Madam May, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Thomas Norris and Michael Thornton, war buddies and great friends, sat together in May of 2001 to tell their stories to the Academy of Achievement. It was a miraculous thing that Lieutenant Norris was there at all. When he was wounded in Vietnam in 1972, he was given zero chance of surviving, even after a mind-boggling rescue by the man sitting next to him.
My injury, when you see the death and destruction to other people that you see in war, I mean, what I have is nothing. So I lost an eye and part of my head and brain and had some other bodily injuries, but what is that? I mean, I have another eye. You just go on. You go on with what you've got left and make the best of it and get on with your life.
We will certainly hear the dramatic tale of how Lieutenant Thomas Norris and Petty Officer Michael Thornton's lives became forever entwined. But I want to go back 6 months earlier, before they'd even met, when Tommy Norris carried out a breathtaking rescue operation of his own, retrieving two downed pilots from across enemy lines. It was the spring of 1972. President Richard Nixon was pulling U.S. troops out of Vietnam, turning the fighting over to the South Vietnamese military. By April, there were only a few American units still engaged. The North Vietnamese Army seized the moment and poured into the South. It was called the Easter Offensive. Ultimately, it resulted in the North's complete takeover of the South. But in the early days of the Easter Offensive, the United States retaliated with B-52s, bombing the North Vietnamese forces from the air. During one of those strikes, an Air Force plane was shot down, a plane whose job it was to jam the radars of surface-to-air missiles so they wouldn't reach the B-52s. Tommy Norris picks up the story.
That plane was shot down. It had a crew of six aboard, and the only survivor was a lieutenant colonel, Lieutenant Colonel Gene Hamilton. He came up, and when he came up on a survival radio, effort was immediately instituted to try and rescue him. That effort consisted of a Cobra gunship and a UH-1 Huey helicopter. They went and tried to do a pickup attempt. They were both shot up. The Huey went down, hit a three-man crew. Two of them were killed. One of them was captured. On the second day, April 3rd, two Jolligan rescue attempts were made on a pickup, and both of those helicopters were so badly shot up they had to abort the mission. And a Ford air control aircraft was shot down, putting two more individuals on the ground. One of those was captured. One of those became, just like Hamilton, on the ground, not picked up in a rescue attempt. The following day, April 4th, they went in with an additional rescue effort, which was a Jolly Green and helicopters, both unsuccessful.
A little more background. Lieutenant Colonel Gene Hamilton was on his 63rd combat mission over Vietnam when his plane was hit. He survived because he managed to eject before the other five members of his crew. He landed by parachute in a dry rice paddy right in the area where 30,000 North Vietnamese troops with tanks and heavy artillery were launching their Easter offensive. Hamilton was a ballistic missile expert and had top secret security clearance, so he would have been quite a prize for the North Vietnamese and the Soviets had he been captured. Now, normally, a downed pilot's chances to evade capture and survive are greatest in the first hours. Lieutenant Colonel Hamilton made it for 11 and a half days.
The fifth day, they didn't do anything. They were just a planning day. On April 6th, they went in with one more Jolly Green Giant rescue attempt. Now, Jolly Green rescue attempt helicopters are the major rescue helicopters that the Air Force has, and they were shot down, lost a six-man crew. The day after that, April 7th, another OV-10 Ford air control aircraft was shot down. That was Covey 282, two men aboard. One was killed, and the second one, First Lieutenant Bruce Walker, was now another missing in action on the ground. So we had three people. As a result of 5 days of effort, we'd lost 14 people killed. We'd lost eight aircraft. We had two people captured, and we had three on the ground to be rescued. The Air Force finally said, hey, we want these folks retrieved, but we're losing too many to do it. What can we do? And that's when I became involved.
Day seven. That's the day Gene Hamilton's fortunes changed. If anyone was going to be able to pull off a search and recovery mission by land across enemy lines, it was Navy SEAL Thomas Norris. He would lead a small team of South Vietnamese commandos to retrieve Hamilton and the other two downed pilots who hadn't died or been captured.
I was briefed on that operation. It was set up by a Marine Lieutenant Colonel. Lieutenant Colonel Anderson, who was a very gung-ho fellow. His idea was that we could get the pilots near a river called the Mugang River. He thought he could get them in the river, they could float down, and we could swim up and pick them up, which seems like a logical plan, but not being familiar with small unit tactics or small unit capabilities, he didn't take into account the current of the river, the temperature in the river, a lot of factors that would have prevented us to stay in the water that long period of time fighting a 1.5 current swimming upstream. I had a team of five people, four Vietnamese, a Vietnamese officer and three Vietnamese soldiers and myself to attempt this rescue. We were taken to a forward base where we worked from. It was an old French cement bunker. And there was a Vietnamese tank unit there and its reaction force with no ammo for their main guns, about three rounds apiece, but ammo for their 50 cals, and the guard force that was under orders to retreat anytime they felt insecure. So we had, that was our protective force. And my team started out the first night in an attempt to find the pilots. Now, the pilots had been told by code what it was they were intended to do, to make their way to the river, get in the river and float down the river, and they'll be rescued. They didn't know where or when or anything else. Only one of the pilots could make it to the river, and that was First Lieutenant Mark Clark, one of the OB-10 pilots that was shot down. And my team patrolled to a position where we thought we could intercept him. We didn't use the river because of the reasons I'd mentioned, but we got to a position where we thought that Clark, we would intercept Clark. And about 2 in the morning or so, 2, 3 in the morning, we heard him in the water. He was breathing very heavily. Water was cold, obviously. He was floating by, but at the same time, we had a North Vietnamese patrol that was passing through our position. We couldn't take the chance to intercept Clark at that time. We didn't know if he'd become excited, say something, fire around or what, because he didn't know who we were or where we were going to come upon him and notify the unit that was near us. So we let him pass. As soon as the North Vietnamese unit passed through us, I slipped into the water and swam downstream to try and intercept Clark, which I should have been able to do. I mean, he was just floating. I mean, I should have been able to catch him. Boy, that was a very devastating feeling. You're going, oh my gosh, I let this guy get by me. Where the heck is he? So I worked my way over to the bank, and I worked my way back all the way upstream. It took me quite a while to get back to my team. I didn't find him. I got up on the radio and gave Lieutenant Colonel Anderson a call, let him know that that Clark got by us, and the next radio check that Clark makes, tell him just to, find a hiding position on the riverbank, and we'll pick him up. That being done, I gathered my team up and sent them overground on land. And I went back in the water and worked the banks all the way back downstream again until I eventually ran into where Clark was hiding. And by this time, we were getting towards daylight. I rounded a corner and I saw movement. I knew it was Clark, so I took my hat off and I put the gun behind me and I started talking to him and telling him who I was and calling his name and mentioning to him some of the codes that he would use for identifiers, so he didn't think that I was somebody setting him up. And he finally stood up, and the relief in his eyes was just, it's inexplicable. I mean, it was just so much relief that here was a fellow American that had finally come to take him out of this mess.
But they still had to travel through a lot of hostile territory to return to their forward camp and bunker. They made it, but later that day they got hit heavily by North Vietnamese mortar and rockets and small arms fire. Many of the South Vietnamese guards at their camp died or were wounded. Lieutenant Colonel Anderson was badly wounded. 2 members of Tommy Norris's team were wounded, including his lieutenant and his chief commando. His support unit at the bunker was now almost non-existent, and he had a team of just 3 South Vietnamese commandos. Only 2 of them refused to go on without their own officer.
Then we went out the next night, ran a mission to try and pick up Hambleton. He said he was getting in the water and he was floating downstream. So we went in after him. And then he radioed later that he was held up, that he couldn't stay there any longer, and he couldn't be in the water any longer. So we tried to get a description of where he was. And the third day, an attempt to drop a survival package was made to Hambleton, and it was dropped within 50 yards of him, 50 meters of him. And he saw it, but he radioed that he couldn't get to it. And as the day went on, it was reported back from the forward air controllers that he was missing his designated call-in times, that when he was calling in, he was sounding very weak, like he wasn't going to make it, and that they didn't think he was going to survive much longer. So I decided to go ahead and make an attempt to get up and find him wherever he, you know, up to the area that he was in. And I called back to the main base and had them build me some canoe paddles, essentially, bring in some medical and some blankets that we would need for him. And that evening, I told Kit, the only other Vietnamese there that was working with me, that I was going to make a an attempt to go and pick up Hamilton. And he said that he would, if I go, he would. He was going. He was a very brave man. I mean, he had no, it was nobody there telling him to do that. His command was gone. I mean, he didn't, and we're going after an American.
Kit was Nguyen Van Kit, and for his extraordinary heroism, he became one of only two South Vietnamese during the war to be awarded the U.S. Navy Cross.
That evening, Kit and I set out, and we patrolled to an area where we had seen some sunken sandpans, and we found one that was floatable, and which a sandpan is like a little canoe. And we got in it and paddled upstream towards where Hamilton was. We went through a number of guard posts.
A fog rolled in, and they got turned around. But the fog gave them protective cover, too. By early the next day, when the fog had cleared, they found themselves right below the bridge the North Vietnamese were using to transport their heavy equipment.
There was troops on the bridge. I don't believe they saw us. I don't know whether they did or not, because we did an immediate U-turn and headed back downstream. But from that position, I knew exactly where I was. And I knew from the location that the Air Force had given me, the general location of where Hamilton was, found him fairly quickly back in some shrubbery and vegetation a little off the riverbank. He was awake. He recognized me as an American. He obviously was happy that I was there. He was in not good shape. You know, he would kind of go in and out of his consciousness, but he would babble. And we tried to keep him to be quiet, and I think he understood that initially. I looked at his injury.
His hand was severely infected. Norris thought it might have gangrene, and he wasn't sure whether it was smarter to wait the night or plow ahead.
Because of his conditioning, I took the chance and decided to take him out then. So we loaded him in the sandpan, put life jackets on him, covered him up with bamboo and vegetation to make him look like a load of vegetation, and Kit and I were kind of dressed like Vietnamese fishermen. Jumped in the sandpan and started downstream.
Farther downstream, they took heavy fire from somebody sitting in a bunker complex on the bank. They were able to escape, and by now, Norris had managed to radio asking for air support, and he got it. Planes came in, strafed both banks of the river, and laid in a smoke trail to provide protection against that guy shooting from the bunker, in case by some miracle he had made it through the assault. By the time Norris and Kit and Hamilton emerged from the smoke screen, they weren't far from their base camp. As soon as Tommy Norris knew that Gene Hamilton was safe, his thoughts turned to Bruce Walker, the third pilot still on the ground in need of rescue. Norris was told to rest before going back in, but before he could get to him, Walker sadly was killed. So Lieutenant Norris went straight on to his next assignment. Months after the rescue that would earn him a Medal of Honor, he started hearing about another SEAL, one with quite a reputation, who was returning for his third tour of duty to Vietnam, Michael Thornton, a young guy from Spartanburg, South Carolina, who was physically powerful, seemingly fearless, outspoken, and full of devotion for God and country. Let's take a few minutes before their war saga to hear about the path that led each man to his destiny. For starters, Mike Thornton was and is a huge guy who dwarfs his friend Tom Norris when they sit together, as they did for this conversation. But as he explained, in the SEALs, size doesn't matter.
They want to see how mentally strong you would be. And that's the whole thing. What type of mental pressures can you take on? And when you go into combat, you know, there you are in combat getting shot at. You know, how are you going to accept? What type of mental strain is when you see your buddy shot or, you know, different types, you know, in different times? You know, you get hit yourself. How do you react on that? How do you focus? Well, you still focus on the enemy. Yes, you're shot, but if you just lay down, as I told someone, you get in the corner, you know, you got to take that fear and use that fear in a positive way. You focus that fear towards the objective. The objective is get the enemy before the enemy gets you back then.
I mean, they've got a lot of kids. They've got big kids. They've got football players. They got, you know, little people like I am. But they're looking for the heart and determination and the mindset that says, I'm not going to give up. And they want to see you push 110, 120% beyond what you think you can do. And they drive you to that. I mean, they can break anybody. Somewhere in training, they're probably going to pick on you and it's going to be your day. But what they're looking for is those folks that aren't going to give up, those folks that are going to keep driving. And they want to instill also, as part of that drive, responsibility for team membership. You never give up your team buddy. You never give up with your team. You get each person through. And if one of your team members quits, you do everything you can to try and ensure that he won't. But if he does, then you take up that slack and you never leave anybody behind. You're always helping each other. But they want to see that drive. They want somebody there that's not going to give up. If you're going to give up, it doesn't matter how big or how strong you are. You're no use to them because they know where you're going. And they know in combat, you're going to be outnumbered every time you go out.
Michael Thornton credits his father, a World War II vet, with giving him his drive.
His whole thing was me to get out of school. So my first goal was to get out of grade school, then junior high, then high school, you know, because he said, I don't care if you're 30 years old, you're going to graduate from high school, because he never had an education, and he believed in having an education. His whole thing is that he wanted his children to better their lives with an education. And like I did that with my children, and they all both have college educations, which is something I was never able to get. But I always said, you always want to try to better your children's life, you know, and hopefully you do a good job.
Of course, to be a SEAL, you also have to be a great swimmer. Thornton also credits his dad there.
My father could never swim, and he made sure my brother and I were young. We went to swimming lessons at the Y. Then they had back then they had state swimming pools, and we swam on the swim teams because he could never swim, and he always wanted to make sure his boys could swim. And I saw the movie The Sullivan Brothers about the five brothers that died during World War II. And those family values that my dad always said, your family, you know, were to die for, you know, basically. And I saw how those five brothers died trying to save the one. And that was a big one. So I said, well, I'm going to join the Navy when I saw that movie. Then I saw the movie, The Frogman, with Richard Whitmire. I said, well, I'm a good swimmer. I want to be a Navy frogman because I love the excitement. I like what they were doing and stuff like that. And when I did finally get out of high school, because when I got out of high school, you're only allowed to miss 30 days. And I missed 78 days, and they still graduated me. So and I think they wanted
me back. They just wanted
back.
To get you out of there.
They didn't want me back. But I took, as Tommy knows, I interjected. I've had a lot of energy all my life, and I took that, and then the military funneled that energy in the right direction.
When Thornton was drafted into the military straight out of high school, he asked whether he could become a Navy frogman in the underwater demolition teams. But in 1962, the SEALs had replaced the UDT. Thornton just hadn't heard of them. But he passed the tests and got himself into SEAL training in Coronado, California. At the start, there were 129 students. By the end, only 12 had made it. The training was brutal and humiliating, but it didn't occur to Thornton to drop out.
My father taught me to never give up, you know. And, you know, I knew I was, you know, and I knew I was there for a reason, you know. And what my father had taught me in my life, you know, and it's something I wanted. I wanted to be successful, you know, and I had set that my goal at that period of time. I was going to make it. They said, you can't do it, and I'm telling myself I can do it, you know.
Tom Norris, who grew up in Silver Spring, Maryland, was on a different trajectory for a while. He went to college and was dreaming of becoming an FBI agent. In the summers, he'd work three jobs to earn enough money to pay his way at the University of Maryland. He graduated and was planning to go to law school, but there weren't deferrals for law students, and his draft number was up. In the military, his goal was to be a pilot.
I wanted to fly airplanes. I wanted to fly for the Navy. I wanted to fly off of carriers. I thought that was the neatest thing going. I mean, I had never been in an airplane, but I used to go out to the airport and watch the planes come in and take off, and I had no opportunity to ever get into one, but I just was fascinated by airplanes, and I even knew what plane I wanted to fly.
He passed the written exam, but then came the physical.
Part of the physical examination was an eye exam. Well, I couldn't pass the eye exam, which was very upsetting to me because I had set a goal. That's what I wanted to do, and now they're telling me, sorry, you're not going to be able to do it because you can't pass this exam. So I went on my own, and I got an ophthalmologist and worked on my vision and my eyes, and I had problems with depth perception. Not as bad as I have now, but I did have a problem with it then, and I had it corrected to the point where I could pass the eye exam with the ophthalmologist, but I couldn't pass it for the military. I went to Andrews Air Force Base, tried to pass it there, could not. Went to Quantico Marine Corps Base, where their medical facility was, tried to pass it there, could not.
A close friend who was a naval flight instructor suggested he sign up as a navigator, a backseater, and go for training in Pensacola, where he might have a better chance of passing the eye exam.
So that's what I did. I went in on a chance because I wanted to fly. I did what he said. I went to Pensacola. And I'm standing in line behind all these other students, and they're holding up this little box that has three sticks on it, and we have to tell them which one's forward or which one's back or whichever. And I'm listening to the kids in front of me, and they're all rattling off the same thing. So I sat there, and I rattled off the same thing they rattled. I don't know whether I saw it or not. But I asked the guy how I did, and he gave me a thumbs up, and I went, "My, you couldn't hurt me the rest of that day, no matter what. I'd pass that exam." Long story short, obviously, that they didn't accept that. It had to go in for a full eye exam, which I did through with a ophthalmologist, naval ophthalmologist. And to this day, I don't know whether I passed that exam or not. I mean, they put dilations in my eyes. I had to sit there for a long period of time waiting for that to take effect. And I was talking to this doctor during the time frame. He was a lieutenant commander, I guess. And I'm just a young kid. I'm not even commissioned yet. I'm just a student. And I think he took a liking to me, and to this day, I don't know whether I passed that exam or not, but he passed me. And I went in as a pilot. I was transferred over into the pilot program, and I went through the training, a great deal of the training, but I was finally, my vision, my depth perception caught up to me. It's a little bit different to try and land on a runway that doesn't move than one that does on a carrier deck. So I was washed out of the program, and then I was in a situation. I mean, I never had failed in something that I wanted to do, and I was devastated. So I was faced with a commitment to the Navy. What am I going to do with it? I didn't particularly want to go aboard a ship. So I had read back in Reader's Digest an article about the SEAL teams, Navy SEAL teams, and then I was, you know, I was off on my next evolution.
The Navy SEALs in Vietnam were originally not engaged in combat. There were only about 250 during the course of the war, and they were there to carry out covert operations and to train South Vietnamese commandos. They didn't live on American bases. They embedded with local people. Michael Thornton was from the West Coast SEAL team. Thomas Norris was from the East Coast SEAL team. So although they'd both been on previous tours and had experienced firefights, they had never met until June of 1972 in Da Nang, after most American personnel had left and the United States decided to resume bombing from the air to try, unsuccessfully, to push the North back during the Easter Offensive. The only people still on the ground were some Army and Marine Special Forces and the Navy SEALs. They'd been living with the Vietnamese people, as I mentioned earlier, running intelligence gathering operations.
I realized that a SEAL platoon is made up of 14 people, two officers and 12 enlisted, and then you divide it into two 7-man squads. And you would either operate as a seven-man squad or sometimes one or two or three people go out on missions. And then we would run, we would penetrate into areas where nobody else would go. We ran into the base areas of the Viet Cong. We went to places where big army units didn't go. And we ran our operations. Unconventional warfare is a different type of battle. It's not online tanks and military units facing each other. We fought an underhanded, dirty, ruthless type of a war. And we were usually always outnumbered. Our main goal was intelligence to give us information on where the VC were, where their heavy weapons units were, where their mortar positions were, where their strike positions were, where their manpower was, and then go target those positions. That's what we went after. And we penetrated into areas where nobody else would go. You know? And I guess if you sat down and thought about it afterwards, you'd probably go, why do we do that? You know, what are we doing in here? But you just wipe it out of your mind and you go on and you gather. You have almost a sixth sense when you run operations. You feel things almost before they happen. It's hard to explain to somebody that's never been there what it's like to work in an area where you're outnumbered. I mean,
every time.
And you can be not make it just like that. So you depend on your fellow member and your team to do what they're supposed to do.
I mean, they were your family. They were, it's like my father, the values, your family's everything. And they were my family there, you know. And good, bad, war stinks. There's nothing good about it. But, you know, the whole thing is you or them. And we're projecting in areas where nobody else would go. The reason why it was called free fire zones. And these fire zones was a free fire zone because it was controlled completely by the NVA and the Viet Cong.
The North Vietnamese Army and the insurgent communist forces in the South. Well, when Mike Thornton arrived for his new tour of duty, he was assigned to join Tom Norris's team, which was just fine with him. Lieutenant Norris was well known and trusted because of the heroic mission he'd led 6 months earlier.
My boss was Commander Shibley, just the kind of guy you'd give your life for. He was just top notch, and he was a military advisor to commander of our Vietnamese Navy counterpart, the Vietnamese SEAL teams. The Vietnamese commander requested that we send a unit up to the Quang Viet Naval Base, which had now was in North Vietnamese hands, to determine whether or not that base could be taken back by a mission run by the Vietnamese Navy. The Americans wanted to know if there was any aircraft or missile positions being put in up there. And then Dave Shively called me down to asked me if I would take a group up there, you know, and I looked at him and he looked at me and I said, Dave, I can tell you what's up there without going. he looked at me and he said, I know, Tom, but they're asking if we will do it. Will you take a team? And I said, okay. So I went back to where our base camp was and Mike, put on your best gear, buddy. We're going north. And I said, pick the best two Vietnamese you can. And
I picked two Vietnamese that worked with me on previous tours down in the South. Now, we had a Vietnamese officer, which we know as Quan, who knew was going to be a great guy. He got in a boat accident the day before.
Yeah, he did. So the officer that was chosen, he just wasn't as confident as he should have been. This later comes into play when we went into where we went into. Of course, Mike didn't know anything about this. And I put another very solid guy on the boat that went up with us to insert us. That's the team that we picked. So we were, in essence, a five-man team.
And I knew what Tommy was in for, you know, and Tommy and I discussed it. But I would never say no anyway. I mean, I've always felt if you have a chance to, I know what I had been through before, and if you have a chance to be there to help save somebody else's life or him save my life or vice versa, me being able to make a decision under pressure that I know the decision I've made. So, you know, Tommy said, you and I are going to go, and I said, yes, sir.
They set out on their mission, carefully planned out by Lieutenant Norris. They were taken up in what was called a Vietnamese cement junk boat. when they reached a certain location, they were to switch into smaller rubber boats, and using radio communications with a ship offshore, they would vector in.
Well, the problem started developing early on. We were a little late in getting started. The water was slowed us up. We couldn't make the headway we thought we could. The vessels, the American vessels that were supposed to vector us, were not in a position to do so when we got to the area we were going into, so we couldn't get the radar vectors. The boat captain assured me he could get us into where we were supposed to be, so we ran on his reckoning. Unfortunately, we were north of the Quaviet River, but he did vector us in. We got in our little rubber boats and went in as if we were going to where we should go. We didn't know we were not where we were supposed to be until we got on the beach. We took the rubber boats in and we got off and swam into shore and
went across the beach
and started our patrol in a direction that we would have normally gone had we been vectored into where we were supposed to be. And at night, in a heavily controlled area, you move very slowly. You don't, I mean, it's not like you're up just walking into wherever you want to go. It's very slow moving. You stop, you listen to what's around you. You take a lot of time to become accustomed to the area, the sounds of the area, and what the area is like where you're in. And Mike was back at the back of the line. I was up towards the front, and we'd stop and slow down. And Mike had a starlight scope, which is a night vision ocular device. And Mike would come up to me, and he'd say, "Nasty."
I call him Nasty.
He called me Nasty.
Nasty Norse.
He says, Nasty. He says, "I don't see the Quaviet River," which means we're not where we're supposed to be. So he should have been able to pick it up in the starlight scope. And I said, "Okay, Mike." And he'd kind of look at me, you know, like, "Yeah, you you nut. We're not where we're supposed to be." And he'd go back to the back of the line, and off we go. We patrol some more. And every time we'd stop, he'd let me know that, you know, "Hey, dumb, we're not where we're supposed to be."
Well, when you start seeing the things that we were seeing, you see bunkers and bonfires going, and all these guys bouncing around.
We were patrolling through heavy North Vietnamese units. I mean, there was bunker complexes there like I've never seen before.
And there's no way they could have built them. We figured we were in North Vietnam.
It was incredible. So, and we're just moving on through.
Just collecting all the intelligence we can
collect.
And
Mike, I think he's thinking, "What kind of a nut am I with here?" But Mike, being as big as he is, now I can pass for a Vietnamese because I'm small. My body size is such that they don't see my nose and my facial side views. I can pretty much get away with it. There is no way Mike can pass for a Vietnamese. I mean, Mike is trying to make himself as small as possible.
Tom Norris's plan at that point was to gather what intelligence they could, head back to their boat before daylight, and come back in again the next night to the right location.
Unfortunately, it took us a little bit longer to get to where we needed to go to extract than we thought. So with daylight coming on, I said, "That's okay. We'll just hold up here. We'll wait for night and we'll extract and go back into where we're supposed to insert to begin with. And we'll get the battleships on station. They can vector us in." Which seemed like a pretty good idea. We came up to a sand dunes and we had Mike place the people around. Mike comes up to me, looks at a sand dune, and there's a
big old tank.
Big old Russian tank sitting up there. Mike says, "Hey, Nasty, is that what I think it is?" And I said, "Yep."
Well, when we came out, you have to understand the tide rises 18 feet there, and we came out this tide bed at low tide. We were able to stay in there. And as we came out, we went over to the north. We went farther north because there's a village on the south side of us. And behind, so we were going north and south, basically. We were heading north. So we had the ocean on our right flank and had this gigantic lagoon, like a big lake, on our left flank. So the only thing we had to be worried about is our north and south entries, because we knew we had our two flanks covered.
But tragedy was imminent.
The thing that went wrong is there was a Vietnamese patrol, two-man patrol, that came down the beach. One of them was up on a sand dunes, one of them was down on We're down in a beach level area. And we saw them. I mean, we were undercover. We were in pretty good positions. But at about that time, the Vietnamese officer, I mean, and he's thinking intelligence, I think. I mean, he's thinking, we can capture these guys. We can find out what's going on. So he hollers out to his guys to capture him. Of course, his two enlisted people jump up and go after him, trying to capture him. They're commanded to do.
Not the right choice to make.
Not where we were and what we'd been through.
This one guy came up like this, and when he did that, he looked at the guy on the beach, which is 200 yards away, and this guy's got a gun, this guy's got an AK-47. He says, light a mile in. I mean, stop, put up your hands and come here. Well, this guy, all these guys rip off there. This guy was coming up around the sand dunes. I took my weapon. I cold cocked him. And I knew what the village was. And this guy opened fired on this other, the Vietnamese officer. He jumped down behind the sand dune. And I started chasing this other guy down the beach because I wanted to get him before he got back to that village.
That village where he would spread the word.
So I'm chasing this guy down there, and Tommy's up on the top of this big sand and overlooking everything, you know, and all he sees me kind of run up in this jungle, and next thing I hear is a couple of shots, and I shot this guy, but next thing he sees me running back out of this jungle, heading back towards Tommy. There's about 50 people running after me. Tommy opened fire. And I think you shot a law rocket that time.
No, I kept my law rocket for last. Yes, I only had one. But, we opened up on the people, the first force that came upon us.
We set up a perimeter.
And I got up on the radios and tried to get, I mean, I had gunfire positions already positioned, although they were south of us. I mean, I was going to walk our gunfire up from there, pre-position them from there. So I got on the radio to try and get a hold of the destroyer that was going to be giving us a naval gunfire support, and I got a young officer, I'm sure, that was talking to me, and I mean he had never been used to giving gunfire support to a group on land. Normally, they're called in by forward air control or aircraft, and they're firing on a position that he's directing them to, on enemy positions. They're not used to firing, you know, like I was requesting. And he sounded confused, and I was trying to give him coordinates. I had plenty of time. I was giving him coordinates to fire and the type of rounds I wanted him to fire. And the guy says, "Well, how long can you last?" And I can't remember what I said. He says, "Have you seen what's over there?"
Well, I moved up myself up on the point because while Tommy, I've been fighting the bad guys up there. Well, they got so close that we were throwing grenades back and forth, and I'd already shot like 17 guys. What I'd do, I'd take aim because they'd pick up their head, and as soon as they'd pick their head up, I'd aim right there where the sand was. And when they'd lift their head, I'd crack off a round. Then I'd roll to another position, and I'd come up. So they could never really find out where I was. And another reason you do this,
We
moved all the time. They couldn't count how many people we had on the beach.
Right.
And basically, they quit.
They never had a target.
Yeah, and never had a target to shoot at. So I kept picking my targets. I'd knock them off. I'd move to another target. Well, for some reason, they stopped. And Tommy, and I went back up. Tommy says, but before this time, I guess I had gotten hit by shrapnel wounds. They threw a grenade over on my side. I threw the grenade back. Well, in America, the grenade is a 4-second, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 grenade goes off. So they throw the grenade back over. I'm going 5,000, 6,000. I throw the grenade back. I'm going 8,000, 9,000. This grenade comes over again, and I know this grenade. And the grenade went off. I rolled over, the grenade went off, and I was hit 7 times with shrapnel in my back. So I yelled out, and I could hear Tommy yelling for me, and I wouldn't say nothing about that time. These other three guys came over top of the sand dune, and I shot one of them. One fell down on my side, and the other two fell back. Well, when that happened, for some reason, they quit their offensive. They kept coming forward. So I went over to Tommy. I said, "Yeah, I'm okay." And I went up. I kind of crawled over where Tommy could see me, and I was looking across this lagoon. And they asked, "How long can we hold out?" I said, "Look across there." And I had already counted 75 NVA, and they were surrounding coming to the north and the south side of our position at that time. And
by this time, I was talking to another fellow. And I didn't realize this until well after the fact. But the first destroyer that I was talking to was hit by shore batteries from North Vietnam. So it went offline. The second one came up. it could never get in position because of the short of the incoming round. So it could never get into a firing position for us. I didn't know any of this. I'm thinking, these guys, how come they're not firing? I'm not getting any gunfire support, any artillery, naval gunfire support. And, you know, you don't have time to talk to them for very long. I mean, you're in firefight. So as this battle progressed, I mean, it got to the point where, you know, we were being surrounded. I mean, we had about 150 North Vietnamese, I guess, that we counted that were moving in action around us. Remember, there's five of us.
No ship support, no air support, that fell through as well. Even the Vietnamese junk boat with the cement hull where their fellow SEAL, Woody Woodruff, was waiting with mortars could not get close enough to shoot them.
We're not getting any support, and I mean, it's looking pretty bad.
I mean, I got bodies laying all around me.
We're leapfrogging out of here. We're going to have to make our own way to the water and swim our way out. So I called for an extraction, which means we started leapfrogging back. And the last ship that I talked to was the Newport News. I didn't know that. Battleship. It was just another voice. It was a battleship. And, I just gave them a coordinate. And I said, you know, fire for effect. Blow this place away. We're extracting. And
Tommy was given cover fire. And he told
I was cover firing for the group that was coming back. And there was a group of about 15 or 20 VC or North Vietnamese that were, coming up in our position. And I had a LAW rocket, and I wanted to use that as a last. That's a pretty devastating weapon when it's used. And I thought maybe that would give us some time to make, a run for it. So I had set up with this LAW rocket to try and shoot at this group, and that's when I got hit.
Mike Thornton was behind a sand dune about 400 yards away and didn't know what had happened.
Well, the radioman comes back. Dang was the radioman. He comes back by himself. Like I said, I'd already been hit. And he comes back, and he has two bullet rounds through the back of the radio where he had shrapnel on his back. And he says, "Mike, Dawi's dead. Dawi's dead." And I just remembered, I said, "Are you sure?" He said, "Yeah." And I just remembered the last position I saw Tommy when I left. So I jumped, grabbed my gun, and I went running back up there, and I saw Tommy laying on the side, and I thought Tommy was dead. The bullet had entered the side of his head over here and came out.
Blew out this whole portion of my head.
And his whole side of his head was completely gone. I grabbed Tommy. At this time, we were being overrun at the position, so I got down in a kneeling position. I shot several guys right there. When they saw me that I was there, they stopped and they started firing, and I grabbed Tommy and put him on my shoulders and started the run with him. Well, I didn't know that Tommy had told the Newport News to fire for effect. Well, the first round came in, and the concussion hit, and it blew me like 20 feet in the air, and I'm watching Tommy's body fly off my shoulders, and he hits the ground like a kaploop like that. And I get up, and I'm dazed, but luckily the round hit behind me a little bit to the south, and it really got these guys' attention. So I run over, and I grab Tommy to pick him up. I'm dazed from the concussion. And he says, "Mike, buddy." And I knew he was still alive. And I grabbed him and I picked him up. Half his head's hanging out, and I pick him up and I put him back on my shoulders and I started running. And then another 8-inch round came in. When I got back to the sand dune, this young Vietnamese officer had already left and started swimming away. The other two guys that I handpicked got behind that sand dune and they gave us fire support as I was running back, because when they saw me running back with Tommy, they started chasing us. We got the sand dune. I laid Tommy down. I turned around and I opened fired on everybody. And Wilton said, "Mike, what did we do?" I said, "We swim for it." I said, "When I say go, we go." So I got, they were covering me. I got Tommy situated on my back in a fireman's carry, and I was holding him like that. And Tommy had an AK-47. I picked up his AK, then I had my gun. So I said, "Ready, go." And we started running. We got to the beach, and I stumbled and fell. And Tommy rolled over like that. And I said, "Gosh, if they didn't kill him, I'm going to kill him, dropping him all this time." So I picked him up, and I stick him underneath my arms because I was firing like that. And I stuck his head underneath the water, and I felt all this flapping going like that. And it was him. And then I took him, and I grabbed him. And I took him, and I put him in front of me, and I started swimming. Well, when I started swimming with Tommy, the young Vietnamese Quan, which is one of the Vietnamese that I'd picked, comes flying by me. The surf has pushed him in. But he got shot through his right buttocks and he couldn't use his leg. So I grabbed him. I put him on my back. He was on my shoulders. I had Tommy in front of me like this with his arms. I had him wrapped. And I told Dang to hold his arms. And I'm breaststroke swimming like that. And I'm swimming and all I could do is see all these bullets just flying through the water. After we got past the surf zone, they just kept flying past us. And after we got out of the range of fire, the Newport News, I saw them turn around and leave. I said, where the hell are they going? And they were called off the line. They thought we all were dead. So when I got out there, I took my life jacket, put my life jacket over Tommy's head. Then I took a 4x4 and I took one 4x4, which is a gut patch about like this, and I stuffed it in his head and I took another one and wrapped it around his head. And I tied, there's an H harness. So I took that H harness and put it around my neck and kept him on top of my neck where on my back. Then I brought the other guy around and put him in front of me. Then I started breaststroking. We're in the water for approximately 3 hours.
I gave him a fit, though, because, I mean, I could see, and the blood would wash off my water. I could wash the blood off my face just for seconds. And I could see two of our Vietnamese. And I knew Mike, obviously, was with me, and the other one was hanging on. And I could see the other one, but I couldn't find the last one. And I kept asking Mike, do we have everybody? Do we have everybody? And he kept telling me, yeah, we've got everybody. We've got everybody. But I couldn't see him. And I finally turned around and kind of put my hands on Mike's shoulders and pushed myself up. Mike, I thought, what's this nut doing? And I see his little head way out to sea, and I just relaxed after that. He said I just kind of went.
He just went down.
Went.
And we figured
once I realized we had
everybody.
Had everybody.
Because I never saw the guy because of the way the swells were going, and the Vietnamese, the young officer, which was way ahead of us, was picked up by Woody Woodruff. And said, where is everybody? Where is everybody? And he says, Mike, I don't know. He says, Tommy's dead. Mike's mission in action. He said the only two people he saw was still alive were the two Vietnamese he had left there. And finally, I took Tommy's AK-47, which I had hanging on with me, and started shooting in the air when I saw the jump.
From there, they were able to call the Newport News and let them know that Mike Thornton and Tommy Norris were, in fact, alive, but badly wounded and needed to come on board. Thornton stood holding his friend, but he was wounded as well and was standing in a large pool of his own blood after swimming for 3 hours while carrying two men while wounded by shrapnel. And, by the way, after single-handedly killing more than 30 North Vietnamese soldiers.
But then my concern went to Tommy because, I mean, like I say, a camaraderie and a love that you feel for each other. Because I know if that had been me on that beach, that would have been Tommy who would have done the same thing for me. I mean, and that's what type of commitment you have to have in each other and belief you have to have in each other to do something like that. I carried Tommy down to the operating room. I wouldn't let him go, and the doctor came to me, he said, Mike, there's no way he's going to make it. The water, the warmness and the cleanness of the water and the salt helped cleanse his wound, baked like that. And his body next to my body with the heat, they said that's what kept him from going in deep shock because we had that layer of water and I was swimming so hard and my body heat went to his body heat too. And with the hot sun, they said that's what probably kept him going in deep shock.
Lieutenant Tommy Norris was medevaced to Da Nang and then to Clark's Air Force Base in the Philippines and finally to Bethesda, Maryland, where he had many, many surgeries and years of rehab.
If you're asking me, how did this affect me? Obviously, it changed my whole lifestyle and existence. I no longer could stay in the Navy. I went into the hospital. I spent from 1972 to 1975 in surgeries, and after that, until 1978 in minor surgeries. So I was going back and forth for repair work. The Navy retired me as a result of that. Wouldn't let me stay with the units. So that part of my life totally changed. I had the injuries that I had to deal with. But you know, some people look at you and say, how did you make it through that? And I think the reason I made it through was because of the type of training that I had way back when we went through basic UDT SEAL training. I mean, there's an ingrown desire and determination that you're not going to quit no matter what. And the doctors even came in and said, we didn't think we were ever going to save you. He said, I don't know how, you know, you made it, stayed alive and made it through. But he said, you just wouldn't give up. And I think that's part of what it was. You just have a determination not to give up.
Mike Thornton stayed in Vietnam for a while longer, and then
I came home. I was at home in March of 1973, and actually it was Woody Woodruff, the guy who was on the boat, the extraction and insertion boat for Tommy, came and knocked on my door. He said, I don't know if you've heard or not, you've been submitted for the Congressional Medal of Honor.
He didn't believe it until he got a letter of confirmation.
I was actually awarded the medal on October the 15th, 1973, and Tommy was still going through operations, and they weren't going to let him out because he was getting ready for another operation. And they were looking all over the place for Tommy, and he was staying with me at the hotel in a room, and everybody in the world was trying, and then we had to try to get him, get the clearance to get into the White House. Well, it was really funny. We got him clearance to get in the White House, and we went to the White House for everybody to go to the White House. Everybody was cleared to go in the White House but me. I was not cleared to go in the White House. I started, well, giving the medal to Tommy. But I'll never forget that day. My mom and dad was there. My brother was there. Tommy was there. And the president asked me and said, Mike, you know, what does this mean to you? And it was President Nixon, and we're in the East Room. And I said, sir, if you could take something, cut this in half, I'd like to give the other half of this medal to the gentleman standing behind me. And that was Tommy.
Fortunately, Tommy Norris received his own Medal of Honor several years later for the earlier rescue of Gene Hambleton and Mark Clark.
I feel much like Mike does. That medal does not belong to me. It belongs to, you know, all the soldiers over there that fought, lost their lives, and were part of a conflict that they gave their lives for, as well as the teams. That medal was not mine. It belongs to everybody.
Michael Thornton and Thomas Norris speaking together in 2001 at the Academy of Achievement's 40th anniversary program in San Antonio, Texas. After the events you just heard described, Michael Thornton continued his distinguished Navy career right through Operation Desert Storm and Desert Shield. Today, he lives in Houston. Thomas Norris went on after his miraculous recovery to live out his original dream of becoming an FBI agent, where he worked in hostage rescue operations. He is now retired and lives in Idaho. There's a large statue of Thornton carrying Norris over his shoulder at the National Navy SEAL Museum in Florida. It commemorates the only time in a century when one Medal of Honor winner was rescued by another. Wishing you a meaningful Memorial Day from the Academy of Achievement, I'm Alice Winkler, and this is What It Takes. What It Takes is made possible with generous funding by the Katherine B. Reynolds Foundation. Thanks to them, and thanks to you for listening.